The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League, a fine tactical victory for Solskjaer in Paris and a clean sheet for Lampard. How are we meant to fit those into the current narrative? We'll round up all the games. Nicky Bandini joins us to talk through wins for Lazio and Juve. Plus, we'll get a Serie A roundup, including Zlatan taking AC Milan to the top of the league. How excited are we about a European Premier League? And how will that fit alongside a European Super League, a World Club Cup? And will Liverpool and Manchester United keep all the Premier League voting rights when they're not even in the Premier League? Also, the Pickford-Van Dijk Challenge rumbles on. Wes Houlihan really is the best player in the world, and we try and find out if anyone paid $14.95 for West Brom 0, Burnley 0. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Anne-Marie Batson. Good morning.
Good morning, Max.
Nice to see you. Johnny Lou, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty good, yeah. I mean, I watched the PSG game last night. I think we're going to come to that in a bit. Yeah,
we'll come to it quite soon, I imagine. Probably just after we've said hello to Barry Glendenning. Hi, Barry.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. All right, then. PSG 1, Manchester United 2. Quite a fun, open game, this. By the end, it sort of seemed there was no midfield at all. Just counter-attack against counter-attack. Marcus Rashford's late winner. Johnny, what did you make of it?
Well, I thought it was a supremely impressive performance by United, who, as we all know, started the season really slowly and sort of looked a little bit closer to their, you know, to being a kind of a functional sentient team against Newcastle, and here were just really, really good. I mean, the caveat, I guess, is that they couldn't have handpicked a better kind of style of opponent for them that left lots of space in behind for them to counter-attack into, didn't really press them and isn't really used to doing a lot of defending. I kind of wrote in my piece that it was like United had been given the opportunity to play themselves. That suited them, but the game plan was superb. I thought they executed it really well. Solskjaer's change about an hour in, he saw that the back five were getting pinned. He saw that the wing-backs were getting pinned back. Telles and Wan-Bissaka are also really good, by the way. But he changed it to a back four. He brought Pogba on because he saw they were having a bit of a problem getting out. And yeah, he was rewarded with this really well taken late finish from Marcus Rashford, who had missed squandered a couple of opportunities earlier in the game. And so yeah, it was pretty much a complete performance. It was kind of one in the eye. For people that there are people out there who need Solskjaer to do badly for some reason, who need him to be an idiot because they could have invested so much. And, you know, I've had a little dig at him because I don't think he's top class, but you really have to give him credit for that, because the selections, you know, picking Tu and Zabi, giving Telles a debut, changing it in the second half, producing a game plan to nullify the French champions, tick, tick, tick. It was a really, really, you know, impressive display by Solskjaer and United.
Anne-Marie, do you need Solskjaer to be an idiot?
Oh, that's so hard and horrible. No, I don't. And I agree with Jonathan. I mean, I don't think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is world class, but I think he got his game plan absolutely spot on yesterday. And he deserves a lot of credit because he went with some boldness, and that was clearly rewarded, as we see from the goal score. I mean, I really enjoyed watching Telles passing the ball. I mean, I hope he gets another opportunity in another match, because I think he was absolutely brilliant yesterday. Turan Zebi, you know, had the most clearances. I was looking at his stats last night, 91% passing accuracy. It all kind of all came together. And when you were looking at the matchup and you're seeing, you know, the names of Neymar Jr. and obviously Mbappe and Di Maria, that front three, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how is United going to cope with that back line? And, you know, Luke Shaw did incredibly well. I thought Lindelof did really well. And I must give a shout out to Aaron Wan-Bissaka, who played brilliantly on the right back. He managed to control that side very well, pretty much had several players in his pocket. The sliding tackles as well. There was a couple of times when he went in for a sliding tackle and I just held my breath waiting to see what was going to happen from that. And he managed to pull those off really, really well. So I think, you know, Solskjaer deserves a lot of credit. And for me, you know, seeing Neymar either actually on the ground rolling around as he normally does, or with his arms up in the air protesting at the referee, or not tracking back, brought a big smile to my face last night, because I thoroughly enjoyed the fact that Man United managed to keep PSG in their pocket.
Gareth says, has there ever been a manager other than Ole who you'd be more confident would get a result against PSG but not against Bournemouth? It's quite a good point. Barry, what did you make of it? I mean, you've been very critical of Solskjaer, you've been critical of Pogba. you know, you're allowed to be, and they're allowed to be bad, and they're allowed to be good, aren't they?
Yeah, I agree that the Manchester United deserve credit for that performance last night. I must confess, I thought they'd get battered, and I was wrong. But the fact of the matter remains, you know, they still got battered by Crystal Palace. They were still lucky to beat Brighton. They still got absolutely slaughtered by Tottenham. Those results haven't been cancelled out because of one good performance against PSG. PSG didn't play particularly well, and that could well be because they simply weren't allowed to play particularly well. But yeah, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer deserves credit, especially for putting in Tounazibi, whose last game, I believe, was almost a year ago against Colchester. So that's quite a step up. And he was outstanding throughout. It was a hugely impressive performance. And even listening to Solskjaer afterwards, he seemed surprised by how good the performance was.
Maybe he's just he likes to play once a year. It's just his annual, you know, some people who used to play and then stop playing, but just say they have their one, you know, old boys game a year that they go back to. And that's what Tounazibi wants to do. I mean, a lot of people, obviously, Johnny, saying Harry Maguire wasn't there. And, you know, players either get much better or much worse when they're not doing anything and not on the pitch. But is there a case for Solskjaer to keep that setup and keep that personnel?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that he was slightly fortunate in that kind of his hand was forced in that he needed to reshape the defence. United have had a slight issue with being able to kind of build play from the back against teams that want to press them quite high. But also, you know, playing quite a high line, which is what United need to do against smaller teams generally. But here they didn't have any of that kind of they didn't have any of that onus on them. They could sit deep because they knew that they had Neymar and Mbappe and Di Maria in front of them, and that by having kind of Fred and McTominay almost like a, you know, surrounding them almost. So as soon as Neymar turns and gets the ball, he's 40 yards from goal and he's got sort of six or seven players around him. And that seemed to suit United a lot better, I thought. Then, you know, you have the pace of Tounazibi and Alex Telles and Wan-Bissaka, just in case, you know, PSG got the first wave of attack going and managed to get in behind them. And the other thing is, I thought the way they set up defensively suited De Gea as well a lot, because there are times when he has all this space in front of him and he's not quite sure, you know, whether to go or whether to twist or whether to stick. And I think having just having his little kind of bastion of space, you know, his 18-yard box to protect, it really kind of helped him in terms of assurance and confidence. And he made some really good saves. And I think he's kind of been another one who's benefited from getting the backing from Solskjaer. And yeah, he had a great game too.
Producer Jack, in the script, after about 65 minutes, wrote, "Rashford, poor again, wasted a few good positions." He wanted to delete that, but I didn't let him. And Marie, it was a brilliant goal because he's got to make the space, hasn't he? And he's got such a tiny part of the goal to aim at.
Yeah, very much so. And he was just working all the time. And I thought Martial and Rashford up front worked really, really well. And I think, you know, Rashford is somebody who started to get his form back. I know there's been concerns that over the last few weeks, particularly in the Premier League, his form has dipped a fair bit. But again, I think last night he really showed his class and was determined when he got that space and was able to take advantage of that space. He was trying to score goals. And all this nonsense about him, you know, on social media that people are saying, oh, concentrate on your football. I think he's quite capable of concentrating on his football and also challenging people on social issues, particularly around his campaign. So I think he definitely delivered yesterday.
I couldn't disagree more with Anne-Marie there. You can either concentrate on your football or you can concentrate on helping hungry children. You just can't do both, you know. Footballers should play football, eat and sleep. You know, if they have kids, have them adopted or, you know, send them to live with your parents, you know, because you haven't time to devote to anything other than football.
Famously, Pelé stole the food from hungry children, and that's what made him the footballer he was. Okay. Yeah,
and on the flip side, you know, Mother Teresa, a famously mediocre footballer.
She was really, yeah. She was shit for Gillingham, wasn't she?
Bob Barry, Geldof as well, rubbish.
Barry, question for you about penalties, right? Mm-hmm. What about a rule change that keepers just can leave their line? It's okay, it doesn't matter.
I think that should be the rule. I mean, this rule that they have to stay on the line until the ball is kicked is ludicrous. Once the player begins his run-up to take the penalty, I think the goalkeeper should be allowed to do whatever he wants. If he just wants to charge down the field straight towards the ball, let him do it. And then that might, you know, make players who are taking penalties think twice about a pause or a stutter in the run-up. There's no logic to the goalkeeper being forced to stay in his line. He's already at an extreme disadvantage. Why disadvantage him even more?
Anybody disagree with that? I mean, I think I see what you say about sort of charging. If someone's got a particularly long run-up, the goalkeeper might get to the ball first, which seems...
Well, so be it.
Does anybody just lump it out?
I personally just want to get rid of the hop, skip and jump that some footballers are doing before taking a penalty. Just strike the ball, for goodness sake, and get it over and done with quickly.
That's the issue, actually, with a lot. I mean, you see it with Jorginho as well, that if when your method is based on kind of fooling the keeper, it's based on sort of trickery and duplicity, then every once in a while you are going to come unstuck, whereas it's those penalty takers who really just concentrate on smashing the ball into the bit of the goal that the keeper can't reach and repeating that skill again and again, you know, which is what makes Harry Kane such a devastating penalty taker, for example, that seem to have more success.
I just think it's just not commensurate. It's just that save, he's saved a penalty, he's done really well. I just don't think you should get another penalty. That's what I think. I like Anne-Marie, you saying, just get on with it, as if you just want the game to be over. I've got things to do. This run-up is so busy. Jack does point out Fernandes has got 18 in a row before missing against Newcastle last weekend. So it kind of works. The Martial own goal was fun, wasn't it? I thought it was better than Davinson Sanchez's header, but not as good as Ian Dowie's own goal, which I believe is the greatest headed own goal, because I'm almost certain he forgot that he was defending. You know, you can sort of see Martial was sort of slightly tricky, arguably shouldn't have done it. But Dowie does just rise at the far post for West Ham and just head it back where it's come from into the corner, and then looks very sad. A lot of people, Barry, are asking, Paul, for example, if Neymar is any good. This is not a question. This is a question I've heard a bunch of times before.
He is an outstanding player, but his antics, such as they are, play acting, moaning, whining, often with some justification because he does get kicked a lot, tend to rub people up the wrong way. A lot of people, you know, they have their favourite footballer, and then they will not countenance anyone else being put in the same bracket as their favourite footballer. So, you know, if you're a Ronaldo fan, you can't rate Neymar, and that seems weird. But he was partially at fault for the Rashford goal last night, because when Rashford used that burst of acceleration to take him past Pereira, Neymar could have stepped in and tried to get the ball, but he just didn't. He wasn't interested in defending, and then Rashford scored. Neymar played, I think, one of the best passes I've ever seen last night. It was he was on down in the left flank, and just with a swish of the outside of his right foot, he just floated. It was like a golf shot, like with is it draw or fade, where it curled out and then back in. Just over the head of Fred into Kurzawa, who then sent in a cross, which sort of dropped onto the crossbar. But if PSG had scored from that, I think people would be absolutely swooning over that pass.
What's the best pass of all time? Is it Sheringham to Shearer, Euro 96, or is it...
That's the most overrated pass of all time.
Who was the one in Istanbul for Milan? Was it Kaká?
Kaká, yes.
Yeah. Is that the greatest pass of all time?
I saw an incredible pass on Twitter from the 90s. I think it was from like 93, 94 by Ian Crook.
Oh, yes. It's amazing.
Did you ever see that? It's an unbelievable
pass. For Norwich City.
So he's just, you know, he's just inside the opposition half, and he could, first time with the outside of his foot, bending it round, I think it's against QPR, bending it around a couple of players into the path of some player that just kind of sweeps in from a like an angle that you couldn't possibly have seen. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I think it might have been to Mark Bowen, but I might be wrong. But yes, I'll dig it out and I'll retweet it again. Also, important question for you, Johnny. Do you think Thomas Tuchel is aging more quickly than Barney Ronay? Because there's four lookalikes in this set. You know, there's Tuchel, Ronay, Donald Tusk, and Mr. Burns. And I feel that Tusk and Ronay are going on one journey, and Tuchel and Burns are going on another.
He doesn't look happy, does he? I saw some photos of him earlier this week. You know, wearing his mask, and it was a proper full blue surgical mask. And you know, with that sort of receding hairline and slightly, you know, a slightly Mr. Burns style, you know, maniacal cackle, he looked genuinely sinister. He looked like, you know, somebody who was about to harvest your organs while you slept. He's looking increasingly discontented. There is a lot of talk in France that he's not going to last the season, that they're lining up. Well, Allegri is one name that's been mentioned. Thiago Motta is another one, bizarrely, who's still only 38 and was sacked from his last job at Genoa after 2 months. There's been quite a public dispute between Tuchel and Leonardo over the summer, over kind of the makeup of the squad. And it seems ridiculous that we'd be talking about squad depth with a team like PSG, but they have been quite short. I mean, they lost Thiago Silva, they lost Cavani, they lost Rabiot, and they've lost Eric Choupo-Moting, and they've only partially been replaced. Or was it Danilo Pereira made his debut last night, and I thought he was quite swamped in midfield. He looked like he was chasing the game a lot. But yeah, it's not a happy camp, which is kind of weird when you think of all the things that PSG have won and everything they have at their disposal. It just seems that like this club that is permanently like gloomy for some reason. Like, and I can't remember what the original question was, but.
No, I can't either, but that's fine. Also in that group, RB Leipzig.
Mr. Burns, sorry.
Yes. Who's aging more quickly?
Harvesting organs as well. That was mentioned. Put them in the ice bucket they used to sit on when he had his broken foot.
God, that's sad to think of Tuchel sitting on an ice bucket, which underneath has a few livers and a kidney in it, just to sell on the side. Also in that group, RB Leipzig, semi-finals last year, of course, beat Istanbul Başakşehir 2-0. A brace from Angelino, who's on loan from City, is first. An absolutely amazing first touch to turn Martin Skrtel, who now has hair, and it's really lovely, and he looks completely different. Chelsea 0, Sevilla 0. Perhaps a shame this game wasn't on pay-per-view. Your Dan had like a Scholes-like volley from a corner just over for Sevilla. I think Mendy made one half-decent save, but it wasn't an amazing game of football. David says, considering Chelsea's form defensively thus far, is a goalless draw against Sevilla acceptable at this point? Anne-Marie?
Well, look, these are the two strongest teams in Group E. And as we know, Sevilla are a team that are capable of beating any of the English teams, as we've seen last season with their wins over Manchester United and Wolves, and also winning the Europa League. I was expecting a lot of goals from Chelsea, I must admit, because of their attacking prowess, but it wasn't to be yesterday. I mean, Mendy looked absolutely dominant in goal. I think he's going to be a welcome addition to the team. It was a rare clean sheet for Chelsea. No clear chances from either side, which is quite surprising. But I still say this, it is a decent result for them. And I thought Sevilla would try and at least nullify Chelsea's attack, which obviously they did. But I do wonder about Chelsea going forward. I don't think they're going to have much of a problem in the group stages. It's going to be in that last 16 how they're going to be able to cope defensively, because I think that back line could let them down.
Do we need Barry to be a little bit more patient with Chelsea? They have so many new players, and however good those new players are, if you think they've got Mendy, Chilwell, Thiago, Havertz, Werner all starting, Ziyech comes on as well. I've probably missed one or two. It takes a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see that the more time the front players anywhere are spending together, the more of a relationship they're developing. We saw that at the weekend. I thought yesterday, Thiago Silva coming back, he's a very calming, reassuring presence to have. I'm not sure everyone, I mean, who is being particularly impatient with Chelsea?
I feel the whole pod. I feel whenever I do a pod, I feel almost like I feel Lampard's just sort of get continually attacked. So yeah. You are getting impatient. You and your friends.
But it doesn't make any difference to me whether Chelsea do well or not. I really don't care whether Chelsea do well. I'm not emotionally invested in them. Perhaps it's a thing like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, a lot of people need Lampard to fail. But the fact of the matter is that Chelsea's defence is bad, and one clean sheet does not suddenly mean they're really good. If they can string together 6, 7, 8, 9 clean sheets in their next 14 or 15 games, yeah, then we'll talk. But, again, one clean sheet does not cancel out all the poor defensive performances they've had since Lampard took over.
I mean, I think part of the issue is, as well, is that Chelsea is a club that is almost kind of built on impatience. Impatience, ever since Roman Abramovich took over, has been their founding principle. I mean, how many managers has he got through? How many kind of rebuilds have they been through? How many times have they kind of totally rejuvenated the squad, or tried to rejuvenate the squad in an entire transfer window? It's not just, I think, the public and the media that are driving this. It's the fact that Chelsea is the sort of club where you don't really get like a transition season. Lampard enjoyed a transition season and because of the circumstances he came into. But as a rule of thumb at Chelsea, you don't get a huge amount of time to turn things around, because it's the sort of place that expects instant results, instant solutions and instant progress. So I think that's partly where it comes from.
And instant success isn't necessarily acceptable either, because Maurizio Sarri came in, had one season, won the Europa League, and then is still one of the most unpopular managers they've had in the Abramovich era.
There's just no chance for anyone. Oh, well.
No pleasing them at all, is there?
an eyebrowsing Premier League squad announcement news was Petr Cech in Chelsea's squad as a non-contracted player. Aside from Guildford Phoenix Ice Hockey Club, Kian says Petr Cech is capable of slotting back into his own job. Which panel member would best suit a return to their previous job, pre-journalism? Barry, would you be best suited to sticking your hand up a cow again?
Well, my...
or go back out and stand up?
My most recent job, pre-journalism, was in a betting shop. So after everything we've said in recent weeks, I'm not sure I'd be welcome back.
I used to be a punt chauffeur in Cambridge, punting tourists up and down the river, which quite often you had 20 in a boat, which is one of the largest audiences I've ever had, and also a very captive audience. They couldn't really go anywhere. I reckon I could slot back into that quite well. Johnny?
I think my last job, my last proper job was delivering post. I worked at a post room of a law firm, mm-hmm. just like delivering little orange envelopes to lawyers all day, and occasionally changing the mineral water. You know those giant mineral water bottles that you have to overturn. That was me doing that. So I don't know if I still have the upper body strength. I'm not as young as I was.
Anne-Marie?
I used to work in PR for the construction and transport industry. So if you want to ask me why a train is delayed because there are leaves on the line, I can tell you straight away, even to this day.
So it was every day waking up and just saying, aren't buildings great? Is that what it was? This building is great. And here's why.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. And the other thing was, why is my train delayed for the millionth time? Yeah, definitely.
Also in that group, Ren 1, Krasnodar 1, a banger from Krasnodar, from Christian Ramirez, that they had 5,000 in the 30,000-seater stadium. They all packed into one stand opposite the main camera. It was quite nostalgic seeing so many fans in a stadium. I'm not sure that's the best way of spacing them out, but still. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, Nicky Bandino will join us. We'll look at Juve's win in Kiev and Lazio's win over Dortmund. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Nicky Bandini for this bit. Hey, Nicky.
Morning.
Should we start with Juve's win in Kiev then? 2-0, Morata with both. The first, a follow-up. The second after a brilliant cross from Cuadrado. Question from Pete. What is the feeling on Alvaro Morata in Italy? I think he's top class, but in generally seen as a bit of a donkey / failure in England.
I feel like Morata's got a bit that sort of, I think donkey's overstating it, but I think there's quite a sort of few fans of different teams who look at him and just think he's a bit, I don't know, a bit meh maybe, but in Italy, certainly in Turin, Juventus, they love him. And I think he's sort of especially loved for what he's done in Champions League games, frankly. He scored roughly sort of one goal every three games for the club in all competitions, but in the Champions League, I think he's now got 9-17. That includes obviously a goal against Real Madrid during a run to the final. It includes not a goal, but I think one of the sort of best performances I've ever seen from him in the game that they ultimately lost 4-2 after extra time to Bayern Munich, but which was just a sensational game away in Munich where he played brilliantly for 75 minutes and came off, and then Juventus lost it right at the end after he left the pitch. But I thought he was brilliant that game, and those games are still remembered. I think especially probably Juventus, where the Champions League has been this elusive goal, where it's been the thing that they've wanted most and haven't been able to do. The fact that he has delivered for them in those games is really remembered and makes him quite loved.
Aaron Ramsey looked like he played well. Does he seem a big part of Pirlo's plans? I have a real will for him to succeed. I don't know why. Maybe because I just think he seemed like a lovely bloke.
Yeah, I think he's played pretty well so far under Pirlo. It's like nobody really even now has a good idea of what Pirlo's first choice team looks like. Obviously, this game and at the weekend, they're missing Cristiano Ronaldo, who's been tested positive for coronavirus, so he's currently unavailable, which in itself, you know, the Alvaro Morata thing, Morata never really managed to make things work in Madrid when Ronaldo was there. And there's this big question of whether those two can fit together. There's a big question in general about how all of those attacking pieces fit together, because you also have Federico Chiesa just signed, I thought played pretty well in this game. You've got Dejan Kulusevski, who's playing brilliantly. You've got so many options up front that how Ramsey is going to fit into Juventus's final form, I don't know, but maybe that's also the point. Maybe you don't have a final form and you just have this collection of talents to use.
Nikki, can I ask you about the relationship between both the managers, of course, because Luchesko is the manager of Dino Kiev and, of course, his pupil, Andrea Pirlo, at Juventus. They used to, I think, is it Pirlo was coached by Luchesko when he was 16 years of age. What do you think of that dynamic now, that master and pupil coming together?
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed with Luchesko, I have to say. Like, I don't know what I was expecting from Dino Kiev in this game, but you sort of... you hope for something from them. And it felt like the whole plan in this game was just to spoil. And it kind of worked for the first half. It was a pretty drab game of football for the first 45 minutes, I thought. But it was no real, I don't know, for someone who's been in the game as long and who, yes, maybe has that dynamic, a relationship with his opposite number, I didn't feel like I saw anything clever out of Kiev. I just saw like an idea of, yeah, stifling the game, which in the end got undone by individual players' talents as much as anything.
Nikki, what the hell's happening with Dybala? Are they trying to bomb him out or something? I don't think he's played yet, but like, what are they doing?
I mean, it's, you know, ties into what I was just saying about the number of talents you have there. Dybala's fascinating because he was sort of beginning to become this lost talent, I felt like, under Max Allegri. And then Maurizio Sarri comes in, and Sarri didn't get a lot right, but he got Dybala right. Dybala was really, really good under Maurizio Sarri. Played the best football we've seen from him in years. And now the official, you know, story is he's just not match fit. He's been injured. He's, you know, he's just coming back to full fitness. But there's certainly something bubbling under the surface on a personal level, because he was taken to the game away to Crotone at the weekend when, you know, if he was not fit at all to play, why was he taken? And the feeling, so the story that's come out, what we hear from Juventus is basically, not officially, but what the word that's come out is that Dybala was told he was going to get some minutes. He didn't. So he didn't get minutes against Crotone. He did get minutes against Kiev, but he didn't start. And some of the talk was, he didn't play against Crotone because they want him for the Kiev game. It's still a mystery. There's still time. Again, injury is the official line, but it's definitely a story that, yeah, it's going to keep bubbling up if he doesn't get more games in.
Also in that group, Barca beat Ferencvaros 5-1. We've got Sid on tomorrow, so we'll talk about that a bit more there. Ferencvaros had a goal disallowed, hit the post before Barca got going. Piqué got a red card, giving away a penalty, so he misses the game with Juve next week.
That Piqué red card was quite funny, because I can't remember the name of the Ferencvaros striker who got in behind him. Piqué grabbed him by the shoulder, then took a big fistful of his shirt, brought him down. Obviously a penalty, obviously a red card. He made no attempt to play the ball. But the indignation with which he greeted the red card. And he had just such a long, aggrieved rant at the ref, like, how can you do this to me? And I mean, he's no stranger to a red card. I think that's his 9th or 10th. But it was just comical. Like, just go. You deserve that.
And he did one of those classic thing where they start to go and they go back just to check. Can I just check again? Are we really sure about this? Anyway.
It looked to me like he possibly wanted the ref to go and look at it on the monitor. And I'm not sure what he thought the ref was going to see if he looked at the monitor, because he was banged to rights.
Lazio 3, Borussia Dortmund 1, 13 years away from the Champions League for Lazio. Great result that, Nikki, for them, isn't it?
Yeah, great result. I was surprised, honestly. Lazio have been pretty bad. Bad is relative, but certainly compared to the standards they set last season, they've been very disappointing so far in this campaign. And I guess a special moment for Ciro Immobile is the story that comes out of this one, because he had such a rotten time when he was in Dortmund and he scored the opening goal, played very well. Good sort of bounce back just in a more immediate sense, because the last game he played against Inter, he got sent off. It was a really good night for Lazio. And I think, again, they haven't played well really since the coronavirus lockdown in Italy. They haven't played well. After they came back from that, their whole title challenge fell apart. But this feels like a very sort of, in a sort of looking over the last year sense, the last year and a bit, like a deserved reward for Simone Inzaghi as well, who's had that team playing at times some brilliant football and really getting a great tune out of Luis Alberto as well. I thought his pass to set up the third goal, it wasn't the actual assist, but the ball that he sort of launched the move with was so good. And he's still playing great in that number 10 role.
Also in that group, Bruges won 2-1 at Zenit, last minute winner for them. Zenit's equaliser was a strike, a 30-yard strike from Dejan Lovren. So that's where he is, firstly. And it hit the post and then went back in off the keeper. Nikki, while you're here, can we have a Serie A update? James says, can Nikki talk about the Milan derby, please, a bit? Milan beat Inter 2-1. Zlatan getting both. I mean, it's extraordinary. I just keep expecting him to just stop scoring in a good league.
Yeah, I mean, scoring in a good league and playing well, although I would say that in this game, perhaps got some help from the presence of another familiar old-timer who was not doing so well, which is Alexander Kolarov, who has been a disaster so far for Inter, and gave away the penalty, which Zlatan actually missed, but he scored the follow-up. And again, totally absent on the second goal as well, when he should have been tracking. Ibrahimovic is playing really well. Everyone afterwards was talking about the very gory picture of a lion that he posted on social media, which is very Zlatan to sort of capture the headlines like that. But I think that without question, like everything you hear from what's actually a really young team at Milan. Earlier this season, they had a game which they started while he was out, where the average age was like 22 years old. So they have a really young squad. I think Zlatan has actually been like a really positive presence for them. You hear this from Rafael Leao, Ante Rebic, like young forwards who are saying, no, listen, he's not this sort of arrogant so-and-so in training. He comes and talks to us. He gives us pointers. He tells us where to be. And I think there's that element of it. And it's also an element that all of this nonsense, if Jose Mourinho was doing this, if Jose Mourinho was sort of putting himself in all the press conferences, making everyone talk about him, people would praise him and say, look, he's deflecting attention away from a squad that needs protecting. I think Ibrahimovic, in a weird way, is filling that role of the protective figure in that squad who stops the pressure from being on anyone else. Because if the story is always about him, it's not on Rafael Leao when he has a dip. It's not on Ante Rebic. It's not on all these other players who are also really young and playing really well.
Sassuolo a second. What's that about?
Sassuolo are brilliant. Honestly, Sassuolo are so much fun. I don't think they're going to finish in the top four, probably. But they play, they're like Atalanta light. They're like Atalanta with a slightly less talented group, but the same style of football. Roberto De Zerbi has them playing just bonkers, all-out attacking football a lot of the time. They were 3-1 down this weekend after 60 minutes. They won 4-3, which kind of gets put in the shadow by Tottenham and West Ham, but nevertheless would, on a normal weekend, have been a bonkers thing to happen. Ciccio Caputo up front, 33 years old, but just genuinely playing brilliant football. I think he's going to get a serious look for the Italy squad this summer, assuming the Euros go ahead, which feels as precarious as everything in football at the moment.
Nikki, thanks for coming on.
Anytime.
Nikki Bandini there. Right, let's talk about the European Premier League, a lucrative breakaway European Premier League involving the top English clubs that would supersede the Champions League. Has been revived ideas for it, with the banking giant JP Morgan being asked to seek financing for a new competition, £4.6 billion of it. Liverpool and Manchester United have been approached to join the league, which would comprise 18 teams, three more from England, teams from Spain, Italy, Germany and France, have no promotion and relegation. Sounds great, doesn't it? According to proposals first reported by Sky News. UEFA said, the UEFA president has made it clear on many occasions UEFA strongly opposes a Super League. FIFA says FIFA does not wish to comment and participate in any speculation about topics which come up every now and then and for which institutional structures and regulatory frameworks are well in place at national, European and global level. JP Morgan declined to comment. Johnny, what's this one? I mean, there are so many of these that I sort of get a bit full up and just presume none of them will ever happen.
Yeah, I mean, somebody tweeted a kind of a screen grab from, well, a photo from Arthur Hopcroft, the football man, I think it was 1968 it came out. And when they're talking, you know, he's writing about, there's a lot of talk about a European Premier League, which a lot of the top club owners in Europe want. The first thing to say is that, you know, it's not actually that much of a story in itself. These talks they're always sort of bubbling along in the background. The owners of, you know, the big club owners in Europe are constantly talking about this, but, you know, today that's really all it is. And it becomes sort of almost absurd after a while. Like every sort of few years, when the rights are up for grabs again, you know, when the format's open for negotiation, we're gonna go away and form a European Super. You know, it's a slightly different name each time. It's like either it's the Dream League or it's the European Super League or it's the European Premier League, and everybody shits themselves. Oh no, they might actually do it this time. And well, you know, maybe we'd better give them something. And it seems to me that's kind of what this is. There's very, very little new detail in this that I think there was a story in the FT maybe or the New York Times, I can't remember, about how Florentino Perez was kind of plotting something. This came out almost a year ago now. And it seems to be kind of a reboot of that idea. These things are always bubbling over and the ultimate goal, because, you know, the obstacles to actually seceding and forming a European Super League are so insurmountable. The ultimate goal here is, I think, really just to, as a negotiating tactic.
Javier Tebas, the La Liga president, said a project of this type will mean serious economic damage to the organisers themselves and to those entities that finance it, if they exist, because they're never official. These underground projects only look good when drafted at a bar at 5 a.m. Rory Smith asked a couple of pertinent questions, one of which was, has anyone done any research into whether people want this? Like, are there young people who would really like this to happen? Because I don't want it to happen, but, you know, I'm not young anymore, Barry.
Well, I'm sort of jotted down a few thoughts on this. And the first one is there an audience for this? Who do TV companies and FIFA think are going to watch it? I mean, we have taken a parochial view. In the UK, BT Sport have the rights to the Champions League. Hardly anyone watches it. And particularly, hardly anyone watches the group stages. Their viewing figures are minuscule. You know, a couple of 100,000 probably watched those games last night with Chelsea and Manchester United. And this to me seems like, if this league did go ahead, it would be just like one giant interminable Champions League group stage, which no one wants. And I'm really baffled to know who is going to want to watch this. There's little or no jeopardy involved because there's no relegation. And what happens when this league of all these European super clubs forms and then after a couple of seasons, there's an established Big Six like we have in the Premier League? And again, taking the parochial view, what happens if none of the English clubs are part of that Big Six? It's just going to be stultifyingly tedious. I would have no interest in it whatsoever. I would watch it because I'll have to, but otherwise I wouldn't be bothered with it.
So who do you reckon would be, you know, with all due respect to West Brom or Burnley, in this non-relegation league, to suddenly, like, you know, Juventus or I don't know, Borussia Dortmund or someone, just constantly mid-table, not that exciting, don't do anything. I mean, I totally agree with you, Barry.
Well, Tottenham probably, because I don't even know why Tottenham are in the Big Six in the Premier League. Like, why? Why are they part of the big six? They never win anything. They haven't. They've won one League Cup in about 40 years, but yet they're considered a superpower in English football, and I have no idea why. It's just like they're hanging around with the cool kids, and they're big by association. And this European League seems like it's like a musical supergroup. Like, we all remember Velvet Revolver, where you've Slash and Duff from Guns N' Roses, you've Dave Kushner from Wasted Youth, and Scott Weiland from the Stone Temple Pilots. All musicians from very good bands who, once they left their bands and formed their own supergroup, were absolutely shite. And this is what I think the European League would be.
Don't you think McBusted were quite good?
No.
Okay. Travelling Wilburys. The Travelling Wilburys were class.
I was thinking the Travelling Wilburys as well.
Remind us who was in the Travelling Wilburys, just for Jonathan Wilson.
Orbison, George Harrison, Dylan.
Tom Petty, wasn't he?
Yeah. Jeff Beck, I think.
Yeah, Jeff Beck was in there, yeah.
They were good.
Quite good.
But, you know, they did, yeah, like, I think one album, maybe two albums, and then they kind of, you know, and maybe a tour, and then they all went their separate ways. You know, they just created this thing, and then, you know, they kind of dissolved it. And I think that's if this was like a, you know, an idea to do for maybe one season, I'd kind of be on board with it. But, like, you know, the same teams, the same big teams playing each other every week in perpetuity until the world ends and the seas rush over us. No, not for me.
I think the point I'd also like to add, I agree with everything that Jonathan says and everything that as Barry has said, but I'd also argue about, you know, out of the big six in this country, who would be viable for that? Because they'd all believe that they would deserve a spot. If there was only two spots given to two Premier League teams, the big six would think, well, each one would think they deserve that spot as well. It'd be easier for Germany, because you obviously got Bayern Munich, so they would get that spot automatically. What about Portugal? You look at Porto, but then you think, what about Benfica? It just goes on and on and on and on. Which country would have spots allocated to them depending on the numbers available? I think there'll be massive arguments about that as well. And like you guys, I'm just bored of this. Every few years, this seems to come up time and time again. Can we not just write this down on a piece of paper, stick it in a drawer, shut the drawer, put a lock on it and forget about it for 10 years?
I would actually like this to go ahead, because I think it would be a complete disaster. I just think nobody would be interested in it.
Yeah, well said to everybody. I couldn't agree more. But, you know, why don't we, should we just not report on it the next time they say there's a European Premier League and it trends and everyone gets upset about it? I'm going to finish part two with some sad news. Mike got in touch with us to say, maybe could you give a mention to the Total Soccer Show? It's a football podcast based out in the States. Their British co-host, Daryl Grove, has been battling cancer since January. He's been moved to a hospice. Mike says it's a huge shock. He's a brilliant football podcast host, regularly referenced Football Weekly. You may or may not know of this pod, I'm sure. A lot of our American listeners do. His co-host, Taylor, gave a really lovely intro on their last pod, which must have been incredibly difficult to do. There's a GoFundMe page to help with Daryl's medical expenses. It's the top search on Google if you look for it, and we just wanted to send our thoughts to Daryl, to the whole of the Total Soccer Show podcast, and of course to his friends and family, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. A question from Mags. The Premier League found no foul play with Pickford's tackle on Van Dijk. Should they all be fired and tutted at on their way out of the offices? Adam, an Everton fan, and a reasonable one at that, says, Max, can you and the guys address the berserk reaction to Pickford's bad tackle on Van Dijk? Certain sections of the media have lost their minds. So, yeah, no retrospective action for Pickford. In the build-up to Liverpool's game with Ajax, Georgie Wijnaldum accused Pickford of being completely stupid and Everton of a completely unacceptable approach to Merseyside derbies. We are upset. The way Pickford went in on the challenge was completely stupid, in my opinion. I believe he didn't want to injure Virgil the way he injured him, but the way he took the tackle, basically he didn't care about what happened after the tackle. We have a lot of games against Everton, and in my opinion, they take it way too far in the games we play against them. We know it's a derby, and everybody wants to win a derby, so sometimes you go a little bit over the top, but it was too much. Johnny?
Get over yourselves. I kind of took my eye off the ball this week. You know, I wasn't on social media for two or three days, and suddenly this thing seemed to blow up, and it's still going. I mean, it's 4 days, 5 days later. 4 days later, and it's still going, and it's just getting very silly now, isn't it? I mean, it was a bad tackle. He probably should have been punished for it. He wasn't. You know, there are other football games to talk about, and I think there's a slight danger here that, you know, Liverpool fans certainly, but also it seems like the Liverpool, you know, dressing room and the club itself are kind of getting really hung up on this in a way that is, I think, going to be detrimental to them in the long run. I was thinking back to, you know, injuries and incidents that kind of swung a title race, you know, and even though it's early in the season, you're thinking back to something like Eduardo in 2008, where Arsenal kind of lost their heads there. And it was, you know, it was an absolutely, you know, terrible injury, and there were recriminations, there was justifiably a lot of anger, but they kind of lost their minds a little bit after that. And they were 5 points clear going into that game and ended up, you know, getting well beaten to the title. If Liverpool aren't careful, that's kind of what's going to happen to them. They're going to expend so much emotional energy on this incident that it's just going to totally sap them. There's a hell of a long season ahead, and they've got, what, 33 more games to play. If they don't kind of get their heads right, this is going to be kind of a lasting hangover for them.
But there is a point that, beyond that, that with the PGMOL or with VAR or the referees or whatever, that Pickford doesn't have a 3-game ban. I mean, obviously it's ridiculous to say bans should be commensurate with injuries of the person you tackle. I mean, that's obviously completely ridiculous. But Pickford should get a 3-game ban for that, and he isn't. And I cannot work out how the rules are in place whereby everybody knows he should get a 3-game ban except the people who are saying he's not getting one.
Sure. But, you know, what are they going to do about it now? This feels like it's sort of done. And, you know, there are duff, you know, people get duff decisions, and there are, you know, pretty much every team has been, you know, on the receiving end of.
I suppose they're separate issues, aren't they? One is how Liverpool deal with this, and one is how the referees and the PGMOL seem to be sort of trying to cover their own arse and not say, do you know what, we messed that up. So they're two separate things.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if they mess it up, then if they should kind of get to the bottom of what happened, and it was David Coote again, wasn't it? It was the infamous David Coote. But, you know, mistakes get made. Clearly a mistake got made there. That to me is sort of the start and end of it.
This is a real test for Liverpool, and I think that's what they need to be focusing on now. I completely agree with every single word Jonathan has said. This is going to be a real test of Jurgen Klopp's coaching skills, how he's going to manage this situation. Jonathan's right. Every single team has experienced a loss of a big player. It's how you manage it now. It's how you deal with it. And the fury that I saw online, people talking about that this was assault. I think one pundit called it an actual assault, which I just raised my eyebrows at.
I think I said that on Monday. Yeah.
But it was like, oh, Max.
But I didn't say it in that. I didn't mean it like that. I just...
You I don't know, think you
just,
were the only one, to be fair.
It was just a word that came out.
But anyway. It was Souness as well. Souness.
Thank you. Yep. Called it an assault. Others were saying that Liverpool should automatically get the 3 points. You know, I remember when Ryan Shawcross went in on Aaron Ramsey and Aaron Ramsey got his leg broken. And I remember for a couple of days, there was a lot of fury about it, and then it died away pre-social media days. And it's how Arsenal had to deal with that. And I think that's what Liverpool need to do now. Jurgen Klopp has the players in his squad that he will need to make it work. They're still within all the competitions as it stands. I know that Virgil van Dijk is a massive loss, but I am not a fan of teams that rely on one player to get them through tough times. This is a team event. They need to work together and work it out, and they will come good. I think they will still end up within top four. Manchester City have shown how difficult it is to try and retain the title. We've seen that with the loss of Laporte when he went injured, but they still put in a good shift. And I'm being slightly flippant about it because I think people have some Liverpool fans have slightly lost perspective with this. I know that, you know, Van Dijk is a major, major player, but he's not the only one.
What's your Twitter handle? @Anne-Marie Benson for the Liverpool fans to say, you've lost perspective, Liverpool fans. Two games on Monday night. Wolves won 1-0 at Leeds. Really good game, actually. Calvin Phillips is going to be out for 6 weeks with a shoulder injury, but well done to Wolves on winning that. And West Brom 0-0 Burnley. First goalless draw of the season. The figures are impossible to find. They're being kept under wraps as, quote, commercially sensitive. I don't know if this game happened. Does anybody know if it happened? I don't know if anyone's seen it. I don't know if there's no proof of it existing. Fair play to the Burnley fans. Amongst other sets of supporters, Newcastle have done it. I think Spurs are doing it for the Brighton game. Boycotting pay-per-view, giving money to local food banks. That is a good thing. Football League times. All we need to talk about is I watched, and lots of lower league fans will have used iFollow, and I watched Cambridge v Port Vale last night, and it was brilliant. And I suppose it's strange that you have Premier League fans so upset with paying £15 and Football League fans being so excited to pay £10. It's because I just don't see Cambridge United on the telly ever. And I know I've talked about Wes Houlihan, but this is the first 90 minutes I've seen him play, and he's so good at football and his control. And it's just like every time a Cambridge player gets it, they just give it to Wes. And then he takes the ball in situations in League Two where no other player would take the ball. They would just lump it up the line. And it's just a total joy. And I'm not mentioning our striker who got a hat-trick because I'm worried some clubs will try and get him because he scored a million goals already. He's his leading goal scorer in Europe. He will go nameless. Eyebrow-raising Premier League squad news moment part two after Petr Cech is Mesut Ozil not in Arsenal squad. Johnny, you wrote an article about him, which I enjoyed.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I just find it quite sad. You know, you don't have to take sides in this. Clearly, there's a very complex relationship between Ozil and the club, and that has broken down for a number of reasons. I just, as a neutral, as somebody who likes watching good footballers playing football on a pitch for a team, it's just kind of, how do we get to this point? It's absurd. And, you know, it was the same thing with Bale at Real Madrid, that somehow we've come up with a scenario in which everybody loses. Ozil loses game time. Arsenal have basically junked an asset and are paying £18 million a year to sort of keep him on the sidelines. And you know, we're being deprived of a really talented player, a player who can, you know, until earlier this year was still a regular starter, a World Cup winner, and is not playing for a club that is in desperate need of a creative midfielder. So I suppose it was sort of about that, really, that, you know, it's not an efficient industry that is leaving this amount of talent. And it's not just Ozil. You know, every Premier League club has a player that's just not playing, a really, really good and expensive and well-paid player. Max Meyer, Yannick Bolasie, Danny Rose. There's just so many, there's so much wasted talent out there.
I really liked how you said, you know, it's not why he's not playing. It's just sad that this situation has arisen. And that was the article. And then lots of Arsenal fans said, no, I don't agree. He's not, doesn't run enough or whatever. No. It's just sad that we're in this position. But I didn't think I needed to explain it on your behalf, Johnny, to the people replying to that. Finally, our year says, whatever happened to that Spurs fan who was at a meditation retreat during the Champions League final? That's from George. Remember that, Barry? He'd missed the whole, he'd gone to India, maybe he'd gone to India and had missed basically Tottenham getting to the Champions League final. We've not heard anything since. So who knows?
I thought he got in touch after the final, did he not? I do remember the guy, but I...
Who knows? Well, if you could get back in touch with us, that would be very useful. Just find out, you know, have you gone back into a retreat since the last 10 minutes in the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Sunday? Might be a better place to be. That'll do for today. We're back tomorrow with the Butter Wizard, Mark Langdon, Ed Ahrens, and a bit of Sid Lowe as well. But for the time being, Anne-Marie, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Johnny Lou.
Thanks. Cheerio.
Thanks, Barry Glendenning.
You're very welcome.
See you tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.